See if it can swim back up to the shore. No one's in the house, everyone is out. All the lights are on and the blinds are down.
So come on over the hill. babe, you don't love me. Wednesday, you ain't home. Thursday night, you got it wrapped up tight, girl. Still, I can't get you alone. Or would you let me know what you know when you know it?
What you know?
If you know something good, take your time,
take
babe.
Your time.
I don't mind. If I could, you know I surely would be good to you. I'll be good to you. Saturday we ain't speak. Sunday, babe, I bake your chocolate cake. You can't even give me a please, oh please. Let me know
what you know
when you know it.
What you know?
If you know something good, take your time,
take your time.
I don't mind. If I could, you know I surely would. To you.
Honey Island Swamp Band with Chocolate Cake. Before that, Miracle Legion, Over to Hell, and we started that set off with Squeeze and Hourglass. I want to tell you about one other show we have here in WRCT. Hey, do you remember that kid you picked on in high school? Well, we gave him a radio show. Tune in and hear the Mockster spin the best and worst in indie, punk, classic country, power pop, and so much more. That's Viva La Mock, Friday night starting at 9 with an encore on Tuesday afternoon starting at 5. Exclusively here on 88.3 FM, WRCT Pittsburgh. Okay, time to bring this thing home. Up next, the Go Team, A Bee Without Its Sting.
Noise of falling, I'm sleeping in cafes. Noise of falling, stationed in the guest house, switched your locks and sold the key. Bobcat's busted in the coop, now the chickens got nothing to say. This dust, this dust, this dust, this dust. I hear the drums, the sirens, they started in my mind. Spinning empty bottle in a petrified container with a crescent moon in my eyes. This dust, this dust, this dust, this dust. Nights of horror, I'm sleeping in canopies. Nights of horror.
Sun. Bigger battle, any meeny, money, more, and flower. You're the chosen one.
That was Alt J with Left Hand Free. Before that, Ed Schrader's Music Beat, This Thirst. And we started that set off with the Go Team and A Bee Without Its Sting. That is just about going to do it for me here. This is DJ Chris Wired. I want to thank you for listening to Breakfast for Dinner. As a reminder, this show is rebroadcast every Thursday afternoon from 1 to 2 p.m. here on WRCT Pittsburgh. So you can check it out again then, or check it out for the first time if you missed the Sunday episode. Or change every week. I don't care. It doesn't really matter. Anyway, thanks for listening. We're going to leave you now with something a little bit interesting, at least I think so. It is Walking on Sunshine by Katrina and the Waves, but probably not the version you are most familiar with. This is from their debut album, way back when they started. Also self-titled, so very confusing, but before they were signed to a major label. Anyway, it's a pretty fun version. I enjoy it. A little more indie, which is cool. Anyway, thanks for listening. Katrina and the Waves, Walking on Sunshine.
Cause I just can't wait till you ride to your coming room.
This is WRCT Pittsburgh.
Just say that the Reuters bureau chief worked tirelessly to get the collateral murder video and the military light. They said they didn't have it, they couldn't find it, and then we only saw it when Chelsea Manning very courageously gave it to WikiLeaks to publish. Until that time, the narrative that the military had spun out about that incident was a complete fiction. It was a lie.
That's Chris Hedges, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Chris Hedges. Truth is the first casualty of war. In the old communist countries, comrades who fell out of favor with the party bosses were crudely cut out of photographs. Today, in the digital era, it's easy to electronically eliminate a person and/or their work. Take Chris Hedges. His show, On Contact, was aired on RT, a Russian state TV network. It was on YouTube when suddenly its 6-year archive of programs disappeared. Hedges said this, "I vanished. In totalitarian systems, you exist, then you don't. I have a hard time seeing how a detailed discussion of Ulysses or the biographies of Susan Sontag and J. Robert Oppenheimer had any connection in the eyes of the most obtuse censors in Silicon Valley with Vladimir Putin." And then he warns, "If this happens to me, it can happen to you." Our guest today is Chris Hedges. He's an award-winning journalist who's reported from the Balkans, the Middle East, and Central America. Cornel West calls him the greatest radical writer and journalist of our generation. He writes a weekly column for Shearpost.com. He's the author of many books, including Death of the Liberal Class, Wages of Rebellion, and America, The Farewell Tour. I talked with him on March 28th. Welcome to the program. It's good to see you again.
Thanks for having me, David.
Well, a couple of bookend quotes I'd like you to talk about. Truth is the first casualty of war, which is attributed to Senator Hiram Johnson, and Randolph Bourne's War is the Health of the State.
In wartime, everything is sacrificed for the cause. The press and most of the public always falls in line in a conflict. Challenging the dominant narrative, even if you're speaking truth, is unacceptable. It will see you marginalized. It's certainly been true over the Ukraine conflict, but it's true in every conflict. And Bourne's statement that war is the health of the state means that in wartime, the state, with the excuse of national security, can accrue to itself all sorts of power that it wouldn't in peacetime be able to express. Censorship, control of resources, everything has to be sacrificed for the war effort, so you can't have strikes. And of course, Bourne was speaking about the First World War. Woodrow Wilson was the kind of best exemplar of this. He used the war, and remember, he had campaigned in 1916, I believe. His slogan was, he kept us out of the war. But once the war started, he passed the Sedition Act and the Espionage Act, which was used to shut down his left-wing critics like Eugene V. Debs, who he threw in prison. It was used later to deport Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman, and others. It was used to shut down the newspaper The Masses. None of this had really anything to do with a war effort. It had to do with crushing the left. That sets the template for what happens in a conflict. It is not just about hunting out people who might be sympathetic or working on behalf of those who are defined as the enemy. It's always used to crush the left.
Edwin Starr, in his 1970 hit song, you may remember it, was called War. And in that song, he asks, "What is it good for?" And he answers, "Absolutely nothing." But actually, for weapons manufacturers, it's a bonanza. In a talk that you gave at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, some months ago, which we aired on alternative radio. You mentioned seeing Raytheon billboards in Poland, Raytheon being a giant weapons manufacturer.
Right. Well, that is why NATO was expanded. I was in Eastern Europe in 1989 with the collapse of the Soviet Union as a reporter covering the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania. We naively thought that with the end of the Cold War, NATO had been rendered obsolete. It was a military alliance built specifically to prevent Soviet expansion into Eastern Europe. Everyone began talking about the peace dividend, so we wouldn't funnel staggering amounts of resources and state revenue towards the military, which of course had gotten insane even by the 1950s, where we were building nuclear weapons that it was no longer about what we could destroy in the Soviet Union, but it was geared towards productive capacity so that we could destroy the same Soviet city 20 times over. Those of us who were there turned out to be very naive. The arms industry had no intention of reducing its size or its grip on the state. It was universally understood that expanding NATO beyond the borders of a unified Germany, and let's remember that Secretary of State James Baker in the Reagan administration, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, the German foreign minister, Margaret Thatcher, they all assured Gorbachev that NATO would not be expanded because it was geopolitically unnecessary. Gorbachev was actually looking for a kind of joint security alliance with Moscow, and it would be a provocation. And of course, it expanded anyway. And why did it expand? Well, because large corporations like Raytheon stood to gain tremendous amounts of money. Yes, I was in Warsaw a couple years ago, and there were Raytheon billboards all over the city because, of course, Raytheon is bilking the Poles. The Poles just signed a $6 billion deal to buy M1 Abrams tanks. And of course, we have seen now NATO alliances built with almost every country in Eastern and Central Europe, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, Albania, Croatia, Montenegro, and North Macedonia. And it's a multi-billion dollar a year bonanza. And I think one of the legitimate complaints on the part of Russia is that the Ukraine is a de facto member of NATO, also supplied with tremendous, and of course this has all been augmented since the invasion and war, supplied with NATO compatible weapons and I think we had 150 military advisors in there. One has to wonder if provoking Russia into a conflict wasn't part of the cynical plan on the part of the Western alliance, because, of course, stoking a war, which it's clear that Washington would like to turn into another Chechnya or the old Afghanistan. Remember, Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, began arming and supporting jihadists who were based in Pakistan to destabilize the government in Kabul, which was allied with the Soviet Union, baiting the Soviet forces into Afghanistan with the very costly war that ensued. And they clearly want the same thing in Ukraine. They in the parlance, they want Russia to bleed, but of course, it's really the Ukrainians who bleed. And that is the tragedy, that the peace was really sacrificed for U.S. global hegemony. It was sacrificed for billions in profits. The end of the Cold War should have seen us turn away from investing in arms and weapons and investing in people rather than systems of control to address the climate emergency. And of course, none of that is happening. And meanwhile, the greatest existential crisis to face the human species is taking place at an accelerated rate. The Amazon's reaching the tipping point, the land ice and ice shelves are melting at a far faster rate than climate scientists predicted. Temperatures are soaring, monster hurricanes, floods, droughts, wildfires, crop yields are declining. you know, the collective folly of the ruling elites is propelling us once again towards permanent war.
Brzezinski was a notorious hawk who said he was going to set an Afghan trap, that's a direct quote, I think, to give the then Soviet Union its Vietnam. And it was fairly successful. The Soviets took the bait, as they may have taken the bait this time around as well.
There, you know, even Henry Kissinger, not someone I, you know, have any love for, understood that expanding NATO was going to push Russia. I mean, if you have, you look at the history of Russia, especially going back to World War II, they were invaded by the Nazis. Much of the country was destroyed a century before Napoleon did the same thing. They have very legitimate security concerns. NATO has established a missile base in Poland that is 100 miles from the border with Russia. We almost had a nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union when they attempted to station missiles in Cuba, which is 90 miles from the coast of Florida. We can't excuse what Moscow did. Preemptive war under post-Nuremberg laws is a criminal war of aggression. However, they were clearly pushed and pushed and antagonized until, of course, they unfortunately pulled the trigger. But yes, this I think harkens back to the policy of Brzezinski and efforts to fuel the proxy wars that define the Cold War. I mean, and that's essentially what the Ukraine has become.
In Death of the Liberal Class, you quote Orwell's essay, Freedom of the Press, in which he says, at any given moment, there's an orthodoxy, a body of ideas, which it is assumed that all right-thinking people will accept without question. Anyone who challenges the prevailing orthodoxy finds himself silenced with surprising effectiveness. A genuinely unfashionable opinion is almost never given a fair hearing, either in the popular press or in the highbrow periodicals. Now, you've had some direct experience very recently with being silenced. Can you talk about your experience and what happened with your program on Contact on RT?
Right. So the entire archive of On Contact, which was nominated for an Emmy over the last 6 years, was disappeared from YouTube. Anyone who watched the program could, it'd be a big stretch to call it Russian propaganda. There was never any show on Russia, but it was really a book where I interviewed authors and intellectuals about their work. And it was a very wonky, serious show, the kind of show that would be on public broadcasting if we had a functioning public broadcasting system that wasn't beholden to wealthy donors and corporate elites for their funding. Some of the most recent shows were an interview with Nathaniel Philbrick on his book about George Washington. I did a show to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the publishing of James Joyce's Ulysses with Professor Sam Sloat from Trinity College Dublin. And then the kind of intellectuals who we should be hearing regularly from, who are not beholden to entrenched power, Cornel West, Noam Chomsky, Gerald Horn, Naomi Wolf, Slavoj Žižek, all of that's gone. So those are all, they've been disappeared by YouTube because, of course, it was propagated or put out by RT, American RT International. Well, why? Well, because I had nowhere else to go. You can put them out on sites, I suppose, where there's absolutely no pay. There's no ability, but, you know, in the end, we all have to pay a mortgage. We have to get something for our work. So we were people such as myself, Matt and Glenn are also in the same position. We've all gone to Substack. So I'm at chrishedges.substack.com, and it's subscriber-based. It's the only way left that we can continue to do our work. So I will go down to the real news and reconstitute my show. I will continue to write for SheerPost every Monday. This is Bob Scheer's column. And of course, we were all fired from Truthdig because we tried to form a union and because we were protesting the attempt by the wealthy publisher to fire Bob Scheer, the editor-in-chief, but Bob doesn't have any money. I mean, he runs this thing on a shoestring, basically from his Social Security check. So it's becoming harder and harder for those of us who care about journalistic independence and raising the voice of critics and dissidents and challenge this dominant effort, quite successful effort on the part of the established media to render whole sections of the country, and in particular the poor and the working class, invisible. And I think that's, over the long, my long career, quite distressing, that when I began, and I worked for the New York Times for 15 years, there was a place for journalists such as myself. We may have clashed with the newsroom hierarchy. I'm sure we were considered management headaches, but we were there, people like Sidney Shanberg and others. And now that space is gone. And so what happened with RT was really a reaction, not to RT. They've long waited to shut RT down, and they were quite explicit in the 2017 Director of National Intelligence report about why. There are 7 pages in that report dedicated to RT, and they complain about Russian propaganda, but all of the examples they cite are about giving voice, in their words, to third-party candidates, to Black Lives Matter activists, to Occupy activists, anti-fracking activists, anti-imperialists. That's they tipped their hand. They showed what it was that enraged them, and the invasion of the Ukraine gave them the opportunity to do what they have long wanted to do. And now, of course, you're seeing calls to shut down Substack. I think one of the most disturbing realities for me is the way the Democratic Party and the liberal class has signed on for this censorship. We saw the amazing spectacle of Democratic Congress members calling in the CEOs of Facebook and other major digital platforms and asking them to do more to censor content. And that gets into the question why. And I think the reason is because the ruling establishment, which includes the Democratic Party and the old establishment wing of the Republican Party, is not accepting responsibility for the distortions of neoliberalism and austerity and deindustrialization, which have given rise to these, these QAnon conspiracy theorists and Christian fascists, who I wrote about, by the way, in a book called American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War in America, these gun-toting militias, the cult-like Republican Party that's now been built around Trump. And so rather than dealing with the endemic social distortions or endemic social inequities that have given rise to the most rapacious oligarchic class in American history, they're attempting to silence critics, people who I would argue are speaking the truth about the system, and they're hoping that will make it all go away. It's very much like 1932 in Germany. You have the old establishment coalesced around von Papen taking power, desperately trying to bring back the ancien regime to stave off the Nazis, when in fact what they do by not responding to the very real distress of the German population in Weimar, where to service bank loans they actually cut unemployment insurance, made sure or ensured the rise of fascism. And I think we're seeing the same thing with the Biden administration. You know, every promise that Biden made, the $15 minimum wage, forgiving student loans, his Build Back Better America bill, which has been gutted, which they won't even mention now, the moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions being lifted, the cutting of the supplemental income child tax credits, supplements to unemployment. It's a very similar process whereby that myopia or inability to grasp the political, economic, and social reality sees them going after the people who call it out. And that's why they did what they did.
And YouTube, which disappeared your OnContact archive, is owned by the tech giant Google. I think somewhere you mentioned that the last really critical program on public TV was Bill Moyers when he went off the air in 2015, and there hasn't been anything comparable since.
Yeah, and it's interesting that in the end, Moyers was not funded by PBS. He got, I think it was the Schumann Foundation, or a foundation actually funded his show. Even PBS wouldn't fund it. And it was reduced to a half hour. So you already saw that shrinking space. And then once Moyers was gone, I think that was the last serious exploration of power on public broadcasting. He was not replaced. There's nothing that took his place.
And you also quote, I'll quote again, George Orwell on, if liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they don't want to hear. It is the liberals who fear liberty and the intellectuals who want to do dirt on the intellect. Now, you've focused for many years on the betrayal of the liberal class. What is it that they fear, if Orwell is spot on, that liberals fear liberty?
Well, yes, Orwell is spot on. And that's why Orwell, in homage to Catalonia, took on the propagandists for the Republicans like Gellhorn and Hemingway and others, where he included that chapter on the Barcelona uprising by the anarchists that was ruthlessly suppressed. He himself had been fighting in the PUM. He actually, in fact, had been shot through the neck. So, well, what are liberals? I think we owe a great debt to Noam Chomsky, who has, I think, explained for us, perhaps better than anyone, how the liberal class works. So the liberal class posits itself, I'm stealing all this from Noam, as the kind of moral center, the moral arbiter of society. And it doesn't want that position assailed in any way. And the quid pro quo with the ruling elite is that they will critique the excesses of a capitalist democracy, of its militarism, etc., but never critique the virtues, never critique the motives. And as soon as you begin to examine or critique the motives of the ruling elite, then you are cast out of the liberal class. What's interesting is that the attack dogs that are used to discredit you are the liberals. And I will give my own personal experience. My decision to stand up and denounce the call by the Bush administration to invade Iraq saw me excoriated, not by the right. I was excoriated by the right, actually. I was on Rush Limbaugh. I was a punching bag on all this stuff. But the most effective way to discredit me came from liberals, George Packer, Michael Ignatieff, David Remnick, all these figures who supported the war in the name of humanitarian intervention. And that becomes a very effective technique. Look at Gary Webb, the guy who broke, the investigative journalist who broke the story on the
San Jose Mercury News.
San Jose Mercury News, who broke the story on the collaboration between the CIA and drug dealers shipping cocaine to the United States, taking cash and making it back to Central America to fund the Contra rebels that were fighting the Sandinistas. How was he taken down? He was taken down by the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, all of the mainstream media. I've gone back and read those stories. I actually know the reporters who wrote them. And all they got were briefings from the CIA. They never actually went out and investigated themselves the facts or the evidence that Webb had uncovered. And he was destroyed. I think he committed suicide finally, right? But he certainly had no work in the end. And that's a classic example of how the liberal elites are used and why they're allowed to exist. So yes, Orwell's spot on, and you see it now. Well, you saw it under the whole ridiculous Russiagate stuff, where you know the idea that Trump was elected by Russia is absurd. But the liberals suddenly became the best friends with the FBI and everyone else. I mean, Mueller became an icon in the liberal establishment. You see it now, this kind of warmongering on the part of liberals over Ukraine without any kind of real understanding of the conflict or, I would argue, the consequences of this. So this is the traditional role of the liberal elites, and it's why people like Noam and I hate them so much.
Let's talk about National Public Radio for a moment. You filed for them during the 1980s from Central America. In a recent 9-minute interview with Condoleezza Rice, former Secretary of State, she was never asked about the sovereignty of Afghanistan and Iraq when those two countries were invaded, when she was NSA advisor, National Security Advisor, and later Secretary of State. So the question is, the question's not asked, what is embedded and assumed as proper? And the NPR reporter, during this 9 minutes, never had the temerity or the courage or the insight to ask Rice, hey, you know, what about these previous violations of the UN Charter and international law and violations of countries' sovereignties like Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, yeah, because of course the reporter wouldn't keep their job. I remember on the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, there was this fawning half-hour interview with Rumsfeld on NPR. I worked for NPR. I covered the Falkland War from Buenos Aires for NPR. NPR began as a very different organization, a very scrappy, independent, almost rebellious, and then was co-opted and became essentially no different from the commercial press. In fact, of course, it runs commercials like PBS. They don't call it commercials. They call it sponsorship. They, as you saw, withdrawal of government funding, they leaned more and more on the very centers of financial power that they should be critiquing. I can hardly listen to NPR anymore. And of course, they fill their quote-unquote news segment with fluff, with lifestyle stuff and interviews with country Western stars and to try and cater to a broad demographic. Now, all of that stuff, I'm not against it. I actually even did reporting like that, but not on the news hour. It's not news. So there's been a terrible corruption within public broadcasting. And that, of course, is part of the problem, because public broadcasting is where you should be able to go to hear independent voices. And if you go back to the 1970s, you saw Noam Chomsky or Howard Zinn or even Malcolm X, Angela Davis, James Baldwin, all of these very important figures were given a platform on public broadcasting, but that's gone, that's finished. And that's part of the whole calcification or the atrophy of the press within the United States that has really taken place over my own lifetime as a journalist.
You're listening to Chris Hedges, Truth is the First Casualty of War. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get copies of this program. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Ralph Nader has talked about how he too has been marginalized and has had to do his own program now. He told me he's getting very few invitations to speak around the country.
Well, they went after Ralph in the 1971 Lewis Powell memo, which was the blueprint for corporate control, pushback against the popular movements, what Samuel Huntington called our excess of democracy. They named Ralph. Ralph was in that document. He was named in that document because, of course, he had built very powerful consumer movements. I think there are 24 bills, the Mining Safety Act, OSHA, all this kind of stuff that Ralph actually wrote and then got put into law with the old liberal wing of the Democratic Party before it was destroyed largely by Clinton. So self-identified liberals now have no relationship, this is part of my book, Death of the Liberal Class, with the actual liberal establishment. They're liberal on cultural or social issues, but are in lockstep with the rest of the ruling elite on issues of war and trade deals and austerity and deindustrialization and everything else. So yes, Ralph has been marginalized, I would argue largely blacklisted, because he was targeted and because they're frightened of him. And that's, of course, why he ran for president, that we couldn't get anything done anymore in Congress, that with the destruction of that real liberal wing, he had nowhere else to go. And I worked as Ralph's speechwriter. Ralph's argument was that if we can pull 5, 10, 15 million people into a third party, that's the only mechanism we have left to put pressure on the Democratic Party. But of course, the Democrats made war on Ralph, locked, kept him out of the debates. I guess I got some sympathy with that. I wouldn't want to debate Ralph Nader. Challenged his voting lists, even though they were unimpeachable, because they wanted to run up his legal bills, and then blamed him for electing Bush, which is a complete distortion of that historical moment, because they only counted two counties in Florida, immediately moved it to the Supreme Court, where Bush, defying any legal precedent, was anointed president. It was kind of judicial fiat. I think even Al Gore says he won. That is a classic example of how the liberal establishment is used to demonize, discredit, and marginalize those figures with integrity to challenge the dominant narrative. I just came back from London. I was invited, one of six guests, at Julian Assange's wedding. And then, of course, when I and Craig Murray and others got there, the prison authorities just capriciously, unilaterally, and without explanation, refused to let us in. It was just another cruel act, even on Julian's wedding day. Another example of somebody who has been discredited largely by the very liberal press establishments that publish the material that he gave them through the Iraqi war logs and all this kind of stuff.
You said in an article you wrote, "I like and admire Julian. He provided the most important body of information of our generation about the war crimes, lies, corruption, and cynicism that defines the ruling elites. This information ripped back the veil on the centers of power around the globe, sparking movements and popular protests from Tunisia to Haiti." Why are they so persistently hostile and aggressive vis-a-vis Julian Assange, who's a 50-year-old, you know, independent journalist who founded WikiLeaks? He's from Australia. He's not even an American citizen, yet he's being charged under American law. How does that work?
Well, it's judicial farce. I've sat through some of the court proceedings in London, and it's like something out of Alice in Wonderland. I mean, we have to remember that UC Global, the Spanish security firm in the embassy, recorded all of Julian's meetings with his attorneys and turned them over to the CIA, violating attorney-client privilege. I mean, that fact alone should see the trial tossed out. The idea that Julian, who's not an American citizen, WikiLeaks is not a U.S.-based publication, can somehow be charged under the Espionage Act, that's a real kind of leap there legally. Well, why? Because he's the most important publisher of our generation. He shone a light into the inner workings of power in a way that we got pieces here and there before, but no one had come close to doing what he did. He documented U.S. war crimes, including, of course, the video of the collateral murder video. He exposed that nearly 700 civilians had been gunned down for approaching too close to U.S. checkpoints. He exposed the hacking tools known as Vault 7 by the CIA that gives the CIA the ability to compromise cars, smart TVs, web browsers, operating systems of smartphones, systems such as Microsoft Windows, etc. He exposed the 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, the torture of 800 men and boys between ages 14 and 89 at Guantanamo. He published the Podesta emails, which exposed the mendacity of Hillary Clinton, including ordering U.S. diplomats.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
Thank you.